From Relay FM, this is Downstream, a podcast about the present and future of streaming media. This is episode number 71, recorded June the 14th, 2024. I am your master of ceremonies, Jason Snell, and with me is my guest. Oh, I told you we were going to have guests, people. Here we go. This is the West Coast editor of New York Magazine's Vulture, and on Twitter, I always know him as TV Mojo. It is Joe Adalian. Joe, welcome to Downstream.
Well, Jason, thank you. Long-time tweeter, first-time podcaster with you, so it's an honor to be here in your audio presence.
It's great to have you. Tim Goodman and I used to talk about the stuff that you wrote all the time on the TV Talk Machine back in the day.
The man, Tim Goodman. The legend, Tim Goodman.
Yeah, he is.
He's sort of the myth.
He's out there, yeah, cultivating the myth and legend of Tim Goodman, even now.
There is a mythology around him, yes. He's been slowly building it up over the years, but
I think
the big reveal one day is going to be amazing.
Damon Lindelof is circling,
yeah.
To whatever that is. So we're going to still do Downstream stuff. We're just going to talk about what's going on, and I think we have to start by talking about a thing that I know Julia will regret not being able to take this story to its conclusion, whenever that is, in a year or two or five, which is the sale or lack of with Paramount. The latest is that it sounds like the Skydance negotiations, they were getting it to the line. The lawyers were all getting it together. Everything came up to the point where they were basically ready to sign on the dotted line. And apparently Sherry Redstone said, no, forget it, and walked away and thanked. They released a statement thanking Skydance for their working on the deal, and they walked away, which kind of blew away the industry, it's safe to say. There are a lot of, I would say, kind of catty remarks about how maybe Sherry just doesn't want to no longer go to the parties and be a mogul, which may be true, but it's also kind of mean. Although several people pointed out that her father said, you know, she's not the one who should be running this business, and it doesn't matter. He was not capable of running it, and now she runs it. And there's also a lot of conventional wisdom that says it's only downhill from here. They've got the triumvirate of CEOs, which a lot of people, speaking of derision, are referring to as the Pep Boys. Also mean, but funny, but mean. And the question is really, what's next for Paramount? There are some suitors out there, but it sounds like that a deal, if it comes, is going to be a long time coming. And I know When we talked about this on previous episodes, Julia and I talked about the problem with it being the way that it's structured. You kind of can't, you can buy National Amusements, but then you're going to get sued by all the people who own CBS stock. And so you're in this very difficult situation. The ownership structure is so difficult. And meanwhile, the business itself is really struggling in so many different ways. And this week, I was amazed in the fallout from this, that one of the threads that people are pulling is that the NFL is actually a little bit nervous because CBS owes the NFL billions of dollars on their NFL contract. And, you know, is the company going to be solvent and able to do that, which is pretty wild. I know you wrote about this and said that you maybe think that it's not the worst thing in the world for them to walk away, and that there also possibly are some rumblings about that maybe the Peacock Paramount Plus team up might be one way to solve some of these problems. What do you think about where they are now?
Well, look, there's no doubt there's been sort of a Paramount Mountain of Michigas. It's been insane, and I have to give credit to an industry friend of mine, a former network employee who sort of coined that phrase, but gave me full rights to use it. So I have licensed the term for at least 3 years, which is how long it could be needed. You know, I am glad that our medium-term industry nightmare is slightly over for now. I'd grown tired of the endless speculation and the endless coverage of it. You know, it really, the reason that I'm glad to see this, you know, I think it's David Poland, who's sort of a snarky, sort of grumpy film industry guy on Twitter, and he has his own site, but he sort of said, why is everyone surprised that it fell apart? Look how long it took. And he's sort of right. The fact is, when a deal is a good deal, especially at this level, It happens quickly, usually under the cover of night, and we wake up to a press release. Maybe there's like, you know, some foreshadowing a little bit before, or people talk speculatively. But when, you know, and maybe I'm wrong here, but when Disney was purchasing the entertainment assets of Rupert Murdoch's former 20th Century Fox Corporation, he swept in and it was like, whoa. And then the deal, you know, had to be approved and all that. The fact that it took so long gave me pause. And the idea that, you know, I mean, Wall Street people want this deal because they've sort of soured on streaming. They want profits now. And look, it's pretty clear that the idea that Paramount as a company is big enough to play in the big leagues of streaming, it's a myth. It wasn't right. You know, they're not the only one who made this mistake. I think Comcast is ultimately going to have to come to the same realization. It's barely a given that Warner Brothers is going to be able to survive without making major changes and sort of hoping that other people fall out of the game first, or they can, you know, they've gotten to where they are by just deep cuts and hurt their brand. So basically, I just think the idea that the only way Paramount can be okay is by taking this kid, you know, from Skydance and letting him do what he wants, I just find is ridiculous. I'm not some giant fan of Sherry Redstone. I don't know her. I don't think she's distinguished herself as a CEO or whatever the heck she is, a non-executive CEO and owner. But she's also not a dummy. You know, I think at the end of the day, why sell at your worst value? Right now, you know, they're at the peak of their streaming debt. The TV marketplace is reeling still from the after effects of the strike and Wall Street's change of mind 2 years ago about the trajectory of streaming and whether, you know, growth is more important than profits, and now they want profits. You've got interest rates are high, which makes financing things tough and harder to carry on debt. So you got it. So there's all these things. I think, you know, I'm not saying that this would have been a disastrous deal, but I don't think it's a salvation. And I don't think, and I could be proven wrong, very wrong, in the next 6 to 12 months if, in fact, you know, they default on payments to the NFL. I think that better to sort of wait for the right suitor. I would argue somebody with more of a sense of Hollywood than just sort of, you know, splitting it up to private equity. I still am sort of a fan of somehow Sony being involved, even though it might mean sort of the end of the idea of Paramount as a standalone company, the way Fox used to be before it was part of Disney. But you also get, you know, really smart people at Sony, like Tony Vinciquerra, who's the CEO of Sony, sort of overseeing this business. And you get sort of a consolidation of resources. You get some libraries that make sense. They add things, you know, to the mix, or Paramount adds things to the mix that Sony doesn't have, such as a network, which they may want to get rid of, perhaps. But, you know, I think that this is not the end of the world. How's that?
Yeah, no, I think that's about right. The Sherry Redstone story, like I think part of it, and I know Julia and I talked about this a bit, is you do get the sense that she views this as her family legacy and her father's mm-hmm. legacy. And I think what's difficult is the right way forward here probably is essentially selling off a bunch of the parts and structuring the company very differently, whereas she views it as this family legacy, and she actually brought CBS and Viacom together and put them in the same place. But structurally, I think that's going to be the question going forward is, you're right, it's not necessarily a disaster, but what is the strategy going forward? And are they going to go with the three-headed CEOs? Are they going to start selling things off? And is she going to be okay with a restructuring strategy that maybe, you know, means her dad's business isn't altogether anymore, but might actually end up being the right thing to do in terms of her. Yeah.
Right. But let's talk about the biggest thing, the biggest sort of weight on Paramount right now is the debt from Paramount Plus. And just that's the part that has worked, because the TV network Now, look, all broadcast networks are having trouble with standalone businesses by themselves. But CBS overall is doing okay. They're the number one network by far. They don't have hugely expensive shows. That works. The cable side, not so much, admittedly. But they do have the advantage, at least, of one big, giant, mega-hit franchise for now with Yellowstone. We'll see if they're going to mess that up with Costner and all that. We'll see. And it's been delayed for so long. But probably that's also doing well. And you've got some, you know, MTV and Comedy Central have been dramatically weakened in my mind, but they also don't spend a lot of money anymore. Showtime has been a disaster. They should have sold it when they had the chance and gotten the money. And what I don't understand is why they then sort of downgraded it by it should have been, honestly, the streaming place. Showtime should have always been integral to it the way that HBO was always integral to Max. You say what people on the internet hate the fact that it's combined and I just want my HBO. It's like, no, you need the scale. So if they can get into what they need, I think, is not quite what Sony has. Sony right now is a company. There are people who think that they should be like Sony, which is just make content and sell it to the highest bidder. I think that still exposes you to risk of if the market's not strong enough, you are, you know, if people don't crave your projects, you're on the line for a lot of losses because you have to support overall deals. And then if you don't sell them, those deals don't make sense. But if you can find a way to sort of have a guaranteed home for your content, but not have to pay full freight for the maintaining of that relationship. In other words, you know, basically an output deal where everything you do sort of goes on to this streamer, which is basically what Hulu used to be to the broadcast networks, Netflix was for the longest time to the CW. The CW survived and thrived for a while in the early days of Netflix because Netflix basically said, if you make a show, if you put it on the air, we're going to pay you, you know, a couple million, whatever, $10 million, whatever. We're going to license it and we're going to make sure everyone involved in that show is in profit. So it made sense. It was a perfect deal. So if you can have a streamer where you're not paying the full freight and you sort of become undeniable because it's your stuff with, say, Comcast stuff, or maybe it's at Max, then suddenly, all right, you've got a home for your content. You can focus on that. You don't have to spend the money to market it. You don't have to spend the money that they're barely spending to work on the user interface or making it sure that it works right, the tech of it. You pay a much smaller thing. You know, you don't get as much potentially, but you know what? The feeling is that, quite frankly, they're never going to get to that promised land. They're never going to be sort of one of the top three streamers. So this sort of makes sense, and it allows them to become sort of repositioning themselves as what they always were, which is a mainstream sort of broadcaster, a mainstream sort of company making content for all of America, but not having to worry about being a platform and a direct-to-consumer business, because the company's never been a direct-to-consumer business. And that's the problem for these companies, including Comcast, is they're not in that business of being direct-to-consumer. And as you know, it takes a lot to manage that. There's a lot of an advantage and upside because, you know, you control the platform, but it's really hard and it costs a lot of money. And you need to be able to have what Netflix has, which was 5 to 10 years of runway, where Wall Street said, spend all you want. We don't care. Just get big. And then when the other people said, okay, we'll do that, then Wall Street said, no, you got to make a profit. And, well, that doesn't make any sense because you can't just, you know, you can't just turn the key and become a successful streamer. But anyway, I think that if they can offload that, probably get rid of BET, which they've never really maximized, find something different with Showtime, which doesn't mean anything. You can just, there's not a lot of brand equity to Showtime in the way there is for HBO. I'm surprised that anyone wanted to pay $3 billion for it, but more power to them. Then I think there's a path forward, but who knows? I also admit that I could be completely wrong, and we could talk about Paramount in the next 5 years as sort of, you know, the next, you know, sort of Dumont, but just after 50 years. It's possible, but there's too many great assets. But someone that I trust who sort of knows the business well, who after I wrote my column this week, sort of talking about my thoughts on Paramount, which I've just laid out here, said totally agreed with him. But then also said, the breathlessness about how this deal has to be done, whatever. But this person said, that being said, she's been a disaster and has been for the company regarding Sherry Redstone. I don't think she can, I'm not defending her, but I also think the assets are strong enough to survive. Do you disagree? What do you think about their assets? Do you think it makes sense for them to combine with a Peacock or a Max? Do you think that makes better sense than just trying to be your standalone?
I think you could, I think the streaming part, you made the point that Paramount Plus is part of the problem here. And whether that is making an alliance with somebody and essentially merging it into something like Peacock, or whether it's just shutting it down and saying, we're going to sell our content to, you know, to the highest bidder and just be what Sony is, right? Which is they make content and it goes on other people's streaming services. And they've got some value with the CBS content, right? They've got live sports with CBS. They can make a deal for that stuff. They've got all of those actually very successful CBS programs, both the reality shows and the various franchises that they've got. There's a lot there. And I think the question is, what do they want to be? And are they better off, you know, do they just want to sell out and be gone? I think that there's a question in terms of the regulatory environment, whether reducing the number of movie studios out there is going to be something that anybody wants to see, but you never know. But I think they've got assets. You're right. I feel like getting out of Paramount Plus might be the job number one, which is can we make a deal maybe with somebody like Comcast or Warner Brothers Discovery to kind of pool resources, where it's like you take the platform, you take the content, you're going to get CBS football games in local markets. You're going to get a lot of stuff from that. You're going to get Survivor. You're going to get all of the franchise stuff, that all those dramas and sitcoms that are on CBS. There's a lot there.
Yep, they have something like 70 million subscribers. I mean, they you know, and some of that's global, but
they're just losing money.
They're losing money because they spent a lot on shows they didn't need to make, a lot of originals, and also there are a lot of discounts. They do things with Walmart, but that was a brilliant deal. And that's the thing, is like, I think on a lot of things they've done right, but they just haven't felt essential. Some of it's also buzz. They just don't have the buzz of other streamers. But you know, to me, the team up with Comcast makes a lot of sense, because then you sort of get back to almost sort of what Hulu used to be. Which again, it wasn't enough, but they weren't making as many originals back in the day. But, you know, remember, Hulu was the place you got your ABC, NBC, and Fox shows. Mm-hmm. Now Hulu, you just get your Peacock shows and your Fox shows that no one watches. But you know, if you get the two biggest networks, CBS and NBC, and they are, you know, and all that sports together, it becomes, you know, if you can get the Peacock up to 70, but with all this content, then suddenly that's competitive. And mm-hmm. if they don't spend a lot on shows nobody watches and instead focus on making network style shows and a few like premium shows, I think that's possibly a recipe for success. But what do I know?
Yeah,
I just don't want to see people ceding the ground to the tech giants. And I feel like there's too much of that going on. I would also say this on the studio side, Jason. It is true that it would suck if Paramount weren't standalone. But remember, in the last 5-7 years, we've also seen Amazon and Apple and Netflix establish themselves as a basically huge studios that make a lot more movies. So the money's there. Yes, they're owned by tech companies and people don't like that. And I get it. Tech companies aren't always fun, but they're being run day to day by people who are steeped in Hollywood culture. Jen Psaki is a TV person through and through and knows Hollywood, you know. Netflix, Bela Bajaria, same thing. CBS, Universal, and NBC. You know, Apple, Zach Van Amberg and Jamie Ehrlich, right.
Yeah.
Totally built up Sony. So these are, and they're running it too, like, you know, in some ways, like sort of a network too. Like their shows come out weekly and they put movies in theaters. So there's a lot of hand wringing, and I get it. It's crazy times in Hollywood, but, you know, and the Paramount label would still exist, and you would just, yes, you probably would get some agents would have fewer places to pitch, and it would be more difficult to get great paydays for your clients. And I understand that's why they're out there bad mouthing all these things and saying, oh my God, we have to save Paramount. And I would love to save it too. But have you seen the movie business lately, Jason? Have you seen TV ratings lately? You know, there's a cause and effect that goes on that you can't fight that reality. I'd much rather see, you know, Comcast and Paramount and lots of people who've been in entertainment for a while running things than, you know, Redbird Media or, you know, somebody whose dad is, you know, one of Donald Trump's biggest supporters. Yeah. I'm a little, you know, the Ellison part of it.
The Ellison biased kid. Well, I mean, I think people wanted to see a deal because they wanted to see that deal transacted and see what happens next. And you're right. I think, though, in the end, it's going to come down to who can make a deal or make a strategy or something that makes Sherry Redstone happy? Because in the end, that's the X factor here, is she controls it. She controls it, and she can decide, you know, she's under pressure. She's got debt to pay and all sorts of things that are coming due. But like in the end, she has to be satisfied. And that's the X factor, because I still believe she's motivated in part by her family business and her legacy. I don't know about these stories about she wants to be invited to the parties.
Oh, you know, like, let's just...
But
that
I do
sounds
think,
like spin. There's so much. Know, that's totally. The thing. And I wonder if she didn't get just upset at the constant. I'm not going to mention any names. God bless him. But there was a lot of coverage of just like it. And I wrote this, but it felt like activism. It almost felt like, come on, you got to do this. It's like, there's a part of me that thinks like that's being spun. And like some of it is just, I don't mean to suggest that people who wrote this are just doing the bidding. No, but I do think that they are getting it's listening to agents and other people, and that is an opinion. And I think they all have agendas too. I don't, you know, and those people, went through her gut. Her gut could be wrong. I don't know, but you know, and I also trust kind of the guys that who are running in her executive trio. I think she's got some smarts there. I think George Cheeks is a really smart guy. Sadly, he's not a content guy at heart. He's a more of a business guy, but he's done some smart things at CBS. Brian Robbins is decent movie studio guy who's been in Hollywood forever. You know, so yeah.
I like what you said at the beginning, and I think that that's a good place to end here too, which is this is a deal that dragged on a long time, and that's usually a symptom of something else that's wrong, whether it was the indemnification or the fear of, you know, fundamentally fear of lawsuits because of the way that the deal was going to be structured, where they were going to pay a very large sum for Skydance that probably wasn't justified. And I think that was the red flag, and then everybody kind of tried to get it over the line, and Cher Redstone said, I don't think this is a good deal, and walked away. And that's her prerogative, regardless. And I don't know where it goes from here, but I think that you and I agree. You know, they tried to do too much, and that's not the way forward. So what's the next strategy? And, whether it's the, triumvirate, or what, they're going to have to figure it out. So I guess that we'll keep talking about it, but maybe for your sake, a little less.
Yes, a little bit less. Can we just have a few months? Just unfortunately, what's going to happen? What's going to happen now is a lot more people are going to get laid off, and that's never fun.
Yeah, and the suitors are going to come out of the woods and start making ridiculous offers that aren't real in order to get stories written about them, and it's the whole cycle begins again. All right, let's talk about something else.
exactly.
This episode of Downstream is brought to you by Factor. Warmer, sunnier days are calling. Fuel up for them with Factor's no prep, no mess meals. Meet your wellness goals in time for summer thanks to the menu of chef-crafted meals with options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are dietitian approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So no matter how busy you are, you'll always have time to enjoy nutritious, great tasting meals. Make today the day you kickstart a new healthy routine. Now Factor has sent me meals, and as I've told you before, I think my wife steals them. She does. She takes them to work with her. And that is the greatest endorsement of all. Good ingredients. They, you know, there's a lot of frozen food that you reheat it and it's no good. And Factor is not like that. Factor is really good. The microwave, even the meat, which, you know, I'm skeptical of microwaving meat to heat it up. Just not the case with Factor. It's really all good. The quality of the ingredients, I think, speaks to the quality of the entire product. And like I said, my wife agrees. She is very skeptical of this stuff from podcast sponsors. And I'll tell you, it just disappears. She just takes it. She doesn't even ask anymore. Doesn't even ask. She just takes it because she likes the Factor meals so much. There's so much to love about Factor, though. Makes sense. 35 different meals, more than 60 add-ons to choose on every week. You'll always have new flavors to explore. You can reach your wellness goals this May with dietitian-approved meals and ingredients that you can trust. And, you know, treat yourself to restaurant-quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, blackened salmon. You can keep kitchen time to a minimum, too. Factor meals are ready in 2 minutes. No shopping, prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. So enjoy effortless support for your lifestyle. Choose from 6 menu preferences to help you manage calories, maximize protein intake, avoid meat, or simply eat in a well-balanced way. Go to factormeals.com/downstream50 and use the code downstream50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That is code downstream50 at factormeals.com/downstream50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Thank you to Factor for supporting Downstream. I want to do what we call here at Downstream Sports Corner. Really quick, because there's sports in the streaming world. The what's going on with sports and sports rights, always really interesting. a couple Warner Brothers Discovery things to talk about. This has been a thread the last couple of months. Warner Brothers Discovery NBA deal still hasn't happened. Still sounds like it's not going to happen. They still are threatening. They're putting all the legal documents down so that David Zaslav can try to take the streaming package from Amazon if he wants, or match NBC, which he's not going to do. It's probably nothing. But unsurprisingly, what's also happening when Zaslav is probably going to lose the NBA is that he's busy backfilling. He made the deal for some college football stuff that he picked up the rights on. And now we get another little bit of sports rights picked up by Warner Brothers Discovery. The French Open, a tennis major, was previously on a combo deal with NBC and the Tennis Channel. And I believe the Tennis Channel, as a basic cable channel, by the way, has now lost all of the Grand Slams. It had them. It's lost them all now, which is bad for their carriage in the long run. But it means Warner Brothers Discovery has more content. You can put that stuff on Max. You can put the finals and the semis on TNT. But you can put some of the early round stuff on Max as well. And, you know, the fact is, Warner Brothers Discovery is going to presumably not end up spending many billions of dollars for the NBA. And that is going to be a blow to their ego. It's going to be a blow to their, you know, they're going to have to lay off a lot of people who work in Atlanta doing NBA TV as well. That's probably going to go away as a part of this. But they have put together with college football and tennis and baseball and a bunch of other things, smaller things. It's not that they don't have a Turner Sports offering across TBS, TNT, and Max. So it sounds like Zaslav is already thinking about the future without the NBA in order to keep it going. But it's not a done deal yet. But I think this is really interesting because it's him saying, we know we need sports. There's not a lot out there, but the stuff that is available, we're going to pick up and try to make the best of a bad situation. And, you know, presumably also save several billion dollars they were originally going to spend on the NBA.
You know, I am not a big sports guy and I don't follow it too closely, but I have followed this a little bit because the deal that Comcast is making for the NBA with NBC and Peacock is going to cost that company a heck of a lot of money, and it's going to have severe ramifications to the way that company currently exists. It, by the way, also is one reason I think that they're more interested and motivated to do a deal with Paramount for a blend, because it would relieve some pressure off of Peacock as well, and mean they can be the one place for the biggest network content. But, you know, if David Zaslav really does want the NBA, and there are indications that he has wanted it, and you know, that he's been trying to get it, he certainly has gone about everything wrong. And I think people who have, I'm going to criticize him with saying we don't really need the NBA, and also just it sports things, as people I've covered this industry long enough to know that with sports, you know, you're thinking 5-10 years ahead of time. Like, I remember Rune Arledge back in the day was working up for the Olympic deals as much as he can. Like, you have to think way in advance. Same thing NBC, when they got the Olympics, you were always just, you have to think long term because everybody wants them. You know, you don't want to be caught like CBS was in the 90s when they lost football for a minute, and it was like, oh my God, that was a disaster. They got it back, everything was fine, but it was game changing for Fox, which got the Sunday NFL, and it just made them into a first class network. So, you know, if he wants it, he couldn't have done it wrong. So he couldn't have done a better job just messing things up, apparently, right? We'll see. Maybe he'll pull a rat out of his hat. On the other hand, I don't think he's wrong if he, either whether he gets there, it was his long-term quiet plan and just to get his competitors to bid it up and pay more money, I have no idea. I think the company is better than, I think there's something to not giving in to the terrorists at the NBA. I mean, I'm looking at the ratings this week for the NBA finals with big city teams in there, and they're not that great. Now, they're bigger than everything else on TV right now, for sure. It's definitely, there's an advantage, but, you know, advertising money is leaving network TV. You know, you've got Netflix getting into sports, and it's sort of like $2.5 billion for a company like Warner Brothers Discovery, which is already sort of all but bankrupt. It's sort of like, what? So, like, to me, there's like, okay, you know, they've still got HBO. They've got plenty else there. The cable bundle is dying anyway. And yes, the NBA sort of helps maintain that rate for a little bit longer. But like at one point, you finally say, you know what, there's very little here to maintain for cable. And you just figure the game with cable is accept less money from some of the operators, but spend less and you can still get some okay numbers. Like you look at the cable ratings now and it's like, you know, a few NBA games will pop, but a lot of times they only do a couple million. So is it really worth it? I don't know. I don't know the numbers. I don't pretend. But I think you're right to say that they have a lot of other content. He's picked up the shoulder content, as you've said. They can do partnerships. If Max is suddenly part of a bundle with another network that has sports, then maybe you don't need it to keep people paying the $15 a month or $12 a month for your content. So I think there is some value there. And I think not getting enough attention is the absolute hell that is going to be rained down upon other units of NBC Universe. So, you know, this week at Vulture, one of my colleagues broke a story that I had been hearing rumblings back in November that NBC was telling Seth Meyers, you need to start making major cuts to your budget. And there was back and forth and they were resisting. And well, this week, one of my colleagues found out what one of the consequences of that was. And that was that Seth Meyers losing his band.
Band is gone.
Right. At the end of the day, I can't argue with that decision because the actual literally under 1 million people every night watch on TV. People get their late night content in other ways. It's aggregated, whatever. Who knows if the show even makes sense 5 years from now. But people, when they're watching the show on YouTube, do not even see the band most of the time or the second. So it sucks, but it's the world we're in. So, you know, but NBC is now going to potentially have games for much of the season on Tuesday and Sunday nights. Those are two nights where they're now not going to have an opportunity for primetime content. Now that probably means, by the way, plans that they had originally talked about to get rid of 10 p.m. at least for now, you might have a reprieve because they got to fit those Dick Wolf shows somewhere in. But even there, you know, NBC is offloading one of its Law and Orders to Peacock. There's you know, you're going to see news divisions cuts, you're going to see Peacock spend less on stuff, all for sports. And I get it, sports moves the needle for streaming. It gets people to go to Peacock, but that's also just a function of that there isn't enough other content that's getting people in there. So, you know, will they be fine? Possibly, especially if they do this deal with Paramount, they're going to have a lot of non-sports content. They don't have to spend as much on their own because they'll be coasting off some of those CBS procedurals. And it's a nice little fit because, you know, over the last 5 years, NBC has quietly in primetime become sort of CBS, but a little younger. And they share a producer. Dick Wolf produces, you know, 9 shows or 7 shows for NBC, and he produces 6 for CBS. So, you know, or well, maybe it's 3. I don't know how many it is anymore. There are going to be a lot of cuts, and I don't know that NBC is going to necessarily, at the end of the day, I don't know how good it's going to be for NBC's entertainment brand having to divert so much to sports. At the end of the day, I wonder, and especially since, you know, sports content is content you lease. It doesn't have a return. You can get people to watch it on your network and get the ratings, but then it's gone. But if you spend that money to make a show or a franchise, something like a Yellowstone or a Tracker, which is a big hit on CBS this last season, that can
forever.
It's yours forever. You can sell it internationally. You can put it on multiple platforms. You can put it on Tubi. You can make money and get that friend's money.
And make 5 spinoffs of
it too. Exactly. Great that you've got that NBA, but that's all you got. Yeah. So if that's the only way if you're paying all that money just because you think it's going to get people to pay for Peacock, okay, it's not the best math. And I think that's why Netflix has wisely said, you know, and they've got all the money in the world, and Apple, like, they, yes, you want to have it as part of your mix, you want to experiment, but I don't know. I think Netflix is just as smart to get a lot of people watching the roast of Tom Brady. That's NFL adjacent and gets people who love Tom Brady and the NFL to tune in. People who like competition and live events, maybe they'll see a fight like Mike Tyson and someone else fighting at some point.
That's right.
Or even better yet, do something really cheap like Joey Chestnut, the hot dog eating guy, is gonna be on Netflix Labor Day. Are you kidding me? That's my NBA.
Yeah,
and it costs them nothing.
So,
and I can watch it on repeat.
And I mean, they're going to save NBC, at least they're going to save money by not programming 2 nights of primetime. So they've got that going for them. But
And they're ruining their brand, though. That's the thing. NBC is ruining their brand.
That's the downside.
Their ability, and they're getting out of business that still makes money to focus on a business, streaming, which isn't really and has much smaller margins. And I think it's a balance for sure. But I hate to, you know, and Yeah, and I sound like an old alter cocker, as my people would say.
Here, but, you know, I have got a theory about this too, which is about Zaslav. Like, everybody is really excited when other people spend other people's money, right? And what's a lot less exciting to talk about is prudence. And Zaslav is, you know, he's the villain of the last couple of years. He's put movies that were made in a vault to never be seen in order for tax reasons like that. He's getting paid a lot of money while he cuts to the bone. Like, there are all these things that make him the villain, and, you know, fair enough. But I will say this, I think he's never going to get the credit for doing an eyes wide open analysis of what it would cost to land the NBA. And I think this is maybe going behind his remarks he should not have made about how, you know, they could live without the NBA. That made the NBA very angry. It was a very bad thing. You want to be in a better relationship with them. But I think he's never going to get the pat on the back for doing the clear-eyed analysis and saying, this doesn't make sense for us to spend this much money on this thing. And I know the people at TNT want it because it's their jobs and it's their brand and all of that. But, like, there is an argument that he made the right decision by looking at it and saying, that's too much money. We can spend that money better somewhere else.
Well, but yeah, but see, this is what I'm not sure of is, did he really make that decision? Mm-hmm. Or did he really underestimate NBC's ability and not working with your partners to sort of make sure that you're in the pole position? Because there's a way to do that. There's a way to come in.
Totally.
And we're still talking at the end of the day, a few hundred thousand. Was he willing to spend $2.2 billion?
Well, there was a report that that he was close to agreeing in the negotiation period, and they wanted to reduce the size of the package very slightly, like a handful of games over the course of the entire deal. And that was enough for them to walk away. And so the question is, yeah, were they being stupid, or were they walking away more broadly because they didn't really like the deal to begin with? And I don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah, I don't either. But I agree with you. I agree. If this was a clear eyes analysis, yes, give him, you know, some credit. And I think some of the decisions, some of the conceptual things he's done are smart, of realizing that you need to have windows for your product, that you can't have everything on one platform. You know, people who say, oh my God, you put Sex and the City on Netflix. What, are you crazy? So what? As long as it's still on Max, you know, Sex and the City has been on a billion different places. You know, you want to be able to spread it out there, and it doesn't make a difference. Most people are not watching their content based upon which company makes it, because most people do not understand which studio make things. They understand now. They understand brands. They understand HBO. And so to some degree, it's a little weird, but they also know when shows are older. And you know, so there's some smart things he's done, but he's also, so many times, I want to give him credit, but he keeps stepping in it, and he keeps making decisions that are really not talent friendly. And, and he does come from the world of Unscripted, you know, where he did do well with Discovery. But I remember clearly, when he got into the Unscripted business and started taking control of Discovery, every person, every reality producer I knew just would keep calling me about, like, Discovery's messing up our business. They're demanding this. And then, sure, that's great. He made Discovery successful on the back of a lot of other companies who ended up, like, making less money. And at the end of the day, maybe that's just capitalism, but it also meant a lot of quality producers decided not to do business with them because they knew that, you know, they'd get screwed in the end. And you know, that's as well, he's getting paid what he's getting paid. And that's, so I'm mixed. I'll give you a quick David Zaslav story. Remember when Oprah Winfrey's network launched OWN?
Sure.
And it launched, and immediately everyone and my colleagues in the media were writing about how it was a disaster because, you know, they went off with a bunch of upscale programming and spiritually nourishing, and it wasn't doing that well. And the ratings earlier on were not great at all, especially compared to whatever garbage Discovery had on that network before. I thought people were being too harsh and not taking enough time, and I was going to write a story saying, I think, you know, Oprah and David Zaslav, they sort of know, give them time to fawn the audience. They'll adjust their strategy, whatever. I talked to Zaslav on background, and he sort of told me what he was going to do. And he was very clear about how he had faith in Oprah and how we're going to adjust it. And you know what? He and they teamed together. He showed an ability to connect with Oprah as both a person, as a businesswoman. She had his trust. Oprah talked to me off the record. And then ultimately, 2 years later, when the network turned around on the record, I did a story in New York Magazine. And I saw that Zaslav does absolutely have that ability to come in, see a problem, figure it out, work with really big name talent, and get it done. And I've just always wondered, where is that Zaslav? So often I see how he was with Turner Classic Movies and shelving some of these movies that really he didn't need to, except for just a short term thing. You know, it's weird. But at the end of the day, maybe he just saw the books at the company and realized what trouble they were in, and he sort of had to move aggressively. And maybe that's smart, because as we're seeing, people are having trouble paying their NFL debts. I mean, it's so you've got to be it has been a disaster. So sometimes you got to be ruthless. So,
or maybe it's not him being brilliant. It's just maybe him being him, which is cheap,
and which you need to be right now. Yeah.
Which might fit the times, might not.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So
what a character. Let's move on. And I want to talk about a story that you compiled for Vulture, which was the power rankings. Now, again, having worked with Tim Goodman for many years, I love a power ranking.
Exactly. We don't actually use that for, maybe we do. Maybe I don't know. We do actually in the headline. We actually did use it. So we need to play him residuals. Tell him I'm sorry.
It's all good. But this is, so you basically did a survey of people in the business.
Well,
about the power ratings, people in the business, and also I was there.
Yes, you can't say that.
Oh, no. Somebody very, very good, talented, and capable, who observes the industry from a podcast, was in that group, I believe.
Yes, his name is Jason Mill. But yeah, well, so what we've been doing for the last 4 years is, it's sort of a combination, right? It's sort of, my editors came to me from New York Magazine 4 years ago and said, we want to rank the streamers and we want you to figure it out. Who's the most important? I said, you want me to do that? Who am I to say? But we wanted to find a way to establish some legitimacy. Let's get some scientific formula to this. So I came up with a formula that uses a bunch of different factors. We look at some variables that I sort of look at and rank, sorts of size and scale and how much money they're making, momentum. And then we brought in our critics to sort of rate it on content. So that's 1/4 of the vote. And then the other 1/4 is, yes, an industry panel. That gets everyone talks about that, because we do have all these people who talk and rate it. They don't actually determine individually our streaming rankings, but they're a big voice in it. So a combination of sort of my analysis, some statistical stuff that is unmovable, like the fact that Netflix has more subscribers than anyone, so that counts. And then, yes, what people like Jason Mell say and how they rank it as we come up with a ranking. Exactly.
Yeah, it's a cool idea. And then, yeah, you get to hear the Vulture writers talk about each service, as well as the anonymous people, you know, and you've got various producers and agents and actors and analysts on there. And it's fun to see. You know, did anything surprise you about this ranking when you came to it, where you thought like, oh, that somebody did worse or better than you expected going in? Because I could have guessed. I mean, certainly I could have guessed the top two. I probably could have guessed the top three. I had, you know, I don't know if you were surprised by any of the ratings this year.
I was a little surprised that Disney Plus and Hulu surpassed Max. I knew that Max was going to lose number one. They sort of were there, I think, in part because Netflix was going through some stuff a couple years ago, and because the critics are such fans of Max programming, or have been. But this time, I think the critics really, that the combination of FX and Hulu and Disney in one helped the overall product. And then, you know, if we rated this just Disney Plus, it wouldn't be as high. But the fact is, they are essentially one offering for a lot of people.
Yeah.
If you have Disney Plus, you can get Hulu programming for $2 more. And they're one company. And FX had such a strong year that it helped them on the critics front.
Yep.
They have a lot of momentum. Doing that combination has worked. They're adding subscribers in a big way again. So I wasn't shocked. But Max sort of had a fall from grace in a lot of ways. So I wasn't shocked. I was shocked that I thought that Apple TV Plus would have done better with our critics just a little bit, because they make so much upscale content, and so much of it. I see so many people, regular people, sort of constantly saying they really enjoy Apple shows. Mm-hmm. Our critics, at least at Vulture, are a little tougher. They find some of their stuff. They're more like Jason Poniewozik at the New York Times. They sort of think Apple is the quality of is the best purveyor of mid TV.
Yeah.
Sort of like, it looks quality, but isn't really. Which may be fair.
Not my favorite article of the last few years. Honestly,
I love James, and I will always read anything James writes, because he writes like a dream, and he's not a reactionary, but he's also a critic and a snob. And you know, I'm sorry, someone raised him. And he does make the point. Oh, compared to the 80s, we should have it so bad. You know, it's things are good. Although I thought 80s television was often quite great, and I loved it. But yeah, I think Apple is a lot closer. Apple isn't as good as HBO was because HBO would make a lot fewer shows and just really amazing show. I don't know if Apple makes a bunch of really good shows, and maybe critics want the best shows, and I get that. But it's a lot easier when you're not taking as many bats. Apple takes a lot of bats. FX doesn't, and you know, FX still has its failures. But I love FX too, so happy for this success.
Sure. For sure. I think that's putting Hulu with Disney Plus, certainly. I mean, that Disney Plus, I always felt was, I don't know. They put a lot of value into their catalog, but not a lot of value into their programming of originals. And, you know, they loaded up on Marvel and Star Wars shows. But Julie and I would always say, like, what else is there on Disney Plus? And the addition of Hulu, and you get the FX infusion in there, and suddenly that as a package is full of good stuff, originals and catalog. Like it becomes, I feel like it unlocks a lot of the power of it to bundle those two together.
Absolutely. Which is why the thing is, I thought they always were sort of playing that game, long game, because they knew once they, you know, officially, and I guess there's still technically some wrangling with Comcast over the exit price, but once they had Hulu in their wheelhouse, that was like, you don't need to have Disney Plus also making sort of the same types of shows as Netflix and everyone else, because you've got Hulu. So the only mistake, if they made one, was that they leaned too much on a couple of franchises and made them so expensive and so rare without realizing that maybe you could have just done a lot of less expensive shows that came out more often and got people watching every week.
Those CW superhero shows weren't very expensive.
Exactly.
And they did fine.
And the Netflix shows that Marvel has all had a lot of fans too. And that's they turned it over to the big problem that Disney had was their movie studios and everyone wanting to treat it like movies. And look, I actually loved all the Star. I love Mandalorian each season. I love the Han Solo show or whatever it was. Was it Han Solo? I don't know. I can't keep track of all of them. I've liked most of them. I have. And oddly enough, I haven't watched the one that everyone says is amazing.
Andor. Yeah, it is amazing.
Andor, which I should. Yes. Because that looks like too much work. I like my give me some droids, but I will get to it. But I like it because it's like, this is a big movie like show. And the Marvel shows too, Ms. Marvel, that show, whatever it was called. I thought it's great, but it's 4 or 6 weeks out of the year, you know, and then that's it. You know, and I love She-Hulk, but it's like, and it looks like a movie, but then it's like, it looks like a movie. Why can't it look like a Joss Whedon show from the 90s and just have the amazing Tatiana Maslany just doing crimes of the cases of the week and have it for 13 weeks and I would be so happy. And what they didn't understand is you need a reason for people to open your app. Now they've got the combination, and as long as the Hulu things and ABC things get people opening an app, then I think they're going to be okay. Anyway,
I think they are. So we had Netflix number one, unsurprising, the Death Star back in its slot as the Death Star.
They've stuck to their knitting. You know, people always are surprised when Netflix comes up with a show that critics love. It's like, well, but they make so many that
it's bound to happen, right?
And it's okay that they have a lot of stuff that critics don't like, because that's, if you think of, you know, the story that I did a story 6 years ago for the magazine. It was like my Oprah would call it my aha moment. But when I went there and I sort of realized that they were trying to become the cable bundle, that they wanted to have like Bravo and USA Network and Showtime and HBO and all these different networks under one roof. Well, guess what? In a cable bundle, like, you know, Netflix is going to have a lot of USA shows. They're going to have a lot of NBC shows, and critics are going to be like, oh, that's mid. Well, yeah, but people like them. And, you know, so for the same, you pay a premium price, but you get everything. And maybe, you know, you're going to get a lot of stuff you're not going to like, but ultimately you're going to get something that does work. And so Netflix still makes investment in sort of their HBO-ish, Showtime-ish quality product, and they can get people talking about a baby reindeer or a beef or something like that every so often, then that works. In the same way that Warner Brothers before would have HBO and TNT and TBS and the shows they would sell to CBS and NBC. Now it's just one place.
I don't mind, like, last year I watched The Diplomat. Right.
Loved it.
Is that highfalutin, you know, Emmy bait? No, not really. But it's good. It's like solid TV. And that's the thing, right? Is like, I think Netflix's volume, one of the reasons that Netflix's volume is so important is because they are trying to reach everybody. And that means you can't just make one show for everybody. You got to make lots of different shows in lots of different categories. at lots of different budget points, and the international and reality and drama and comedy and stand up and all of these things. And, and yeah, so you're going to get your Emmy bait, but like something like The Diplomat, you know, which I think did very well and I really loved it. And it was, yes, James Poniewozik. It was mid, but it was well done. It was well made.
Mid. Yeah. Oh, well, my only problem with Netflix is they're also dogmatic about certain things. If you're going to make shows like that, that play like network shows but elevated, you know what? Why don't you give them to me the way I don't want to start a whole other debate. If you ever invite me back, we can discuss this then. But give me those shows. Give me 12 episode seasons of that show and air the episodes weekly
and run them
with
weekly.
A couple other shows.
Amen.
And like most of their shows, I think absolutely like they're getting people complaining about Bridgerton in two parts. So that's, I understand it. Those shows that are made as basically movies or like little mid series. Yes. The audience likes to watch and binge. And by the way, some of these other platforms lose audiences because people forget to come back to the show. And you see the fall off in some of the Nielsen rings I've seen where like episode one does well, but people forget to open it because it's not the same thing.
Right.
But if you can sort of have a few of them say the same thing like that 90s show, my God, it's been over a year. The strike is part of it. But like that's a sitcom along with some of their other sitcoms. Mm-hmm. Just have it Friday night and every week into your queue, one or two episodes drop of some shows that are like people would love it. And you would have to do some thing with your UI, maybe some branding, but it could be done. We'll see if they do it.
It could be done. It could be done. So Netflix 1, Disney and Hulu 2. Max is 3, down from 1, which I think is fair. But, I think I find myself watching Max not as much as the Disney and Hulu combination, but there's stuff there. I find value in it. And they added some of their sports stuff, which was I'm a Fubo household, and they don't have the Turner channels. So I was able to watch, I can watch the baseball playoffs on Max now, which is great. Like that's a win for me. So
it's the way I watch Hallmark stuff on Peacock, which is sad that I never used to watch it before it was on Peacock, but I can watch it ad free.
It's a good deal.
I'll get some Christmas movies in it. Why not? I think Max is good. They suffered a little bit this year in part because HBO was one of its big twixt in between periods where because of the strike, because of delays, not all their shows are operating on a full cylinder. They had, True Detective, Night Country did well, and obviously some of the finales. But I think the cadence is not quite there. But they're going to get back up there. I think that's good. I also wish they would lean more into their library. I understand not keeping things exclusively, but it's been a disappointment even before David Zaslav was around that they don't spend the money, and it does take money, to license deeply into their movie and TV show catalog. There are so many great Warner Brothers classic TV shows that are not there or movies. Like they have a deep collection of movies from all decades and they don't curate it well. And they don't, there's movies from Warner Brothers that are licensed to Tubi that I wish there were a way they would be licensed to Max, especially now that they've got an ad supported one, but they probably think that there's not enough money in that. And maybe they're right. If I wasn't in the business and needed it, I would probably not, or if I didn't get it through my AT&T phone bill, which is I'm probably overpaying for, I would probably not keep Max anymore, except when there was a big show I wanted, because it doesn't even seem to have the same sort of quality rotation of movies that HBO used to have back in the day.
It's been a tough year, but I also get it with my AT&T. So that's kind of nice, but, Hacks is great.
Oh, I love it.
I don't. I enjoyed House of the Dragon, and I'm looking forward to it coming back.
Yep.
It's not great, but it's pretty good. You talk about having something to get you to launch the app being important. One of the things that I think is smart about having a show like, at this point for me, it's Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, is, he only does 30 weeks, 35 weeks a year. Not a lot, but it's enough that it makes it hard for me to say goodbye because I really enjoy that show. And so then they've got me. And I sometimes think that all the streamers ought to get a little smarter about having some kind of replicable thing, whether it's a talk show or a documentary or a sitcom, where you could just order a load of episodes, right? Order 25 episodes, because then you can spread that out and give people like the inability to cancel because it keeps on happening. And
absolutely.
John Oliver does that for me with Max.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why, by the way, you're going to see Max doing procedural shows. He's got one from John Wells that's sort of a medical drama that's going to run 15 weekly episodes.
There
and
you go.
That's going to get people in Smart. There. And it's what Peacock does with the Hallmark movies. Hallmark makes movies almost every week of the year. You know, they're doing it with CNN. They also have the CNN content, which is also smart, although I just can't take most of CNN these days. But you're absolutely right. And in our survey, multiple people cited John Oliver and I hate to say it, Bill Maher, who's annoying to me lately.
Yeah,
but and it's exactly right. And I think you're 100% correct.
But they function the same way, right? Which is, if you like that show,
exactly the same
it's
way.
On 20, 25, 30
and
weeks a year. You can't cancel it. You just can't.
Yeah.
And it's matter, you know, if you like Hacks or Game of Thrones or whatever, it's like, that's great. But like the thing that you come for that, but you stay because you've got this show that you that's on every week and it becomes a habit. And like, that's that, you know, network. I mean, you and I both have been watching television a long time, right? Like it was so easy to throw network TV out with the bathwater with at the advent of streaming, because streaming brings in so many things that are great, including being able to watch on demand. But I'll tell you, the one thing that network TV had wired is that it put your butt on the couch every week because you knew there was something to watch.
Television. Right. Well, I have a whole theory about how our society has gone to hell because we've lost appointments. We've lost where there's we don't get a newspaper that curates every morning what we need to know about the world. We don't have weekly news magazines that tell us the sort of the big picture. And we don't have a network schedule that says this is what you're going to watch tonight or this is
Thursday
the options.
Night.
And Thursday nights. And look, we'll see this coming up this in the next few weeks. HBO Sunday nights are going to be back, and they've kept that. I think other people are going to try that. But, you know, by the way, NBC, they brought Days of Our Lives to Peacock basically to save money. They couldn't support it, but it was also very smart. It got my 80-year-old cousin to finally sign up and get a Roku player in streaming because she didn't want it. Like, the fact that all the streamers haven't invested more in soap operas is stunning to me. Amazon's trying with Neighbours, which is something from the UK, so I don't think it's having a huge impact here. But there's
Australia,
no reason.
Actually, I think. But yeah,
Australia, so right. But it's big in England, right? It's the same, all those countries.
And England, I mean, in the UK, they've got like Coronation Street and EastEnders, and it's the same thing. They're very successful soaps. They're cheap to produce, and they're on every week, a couple times a week.
Young people watch it on streaming too, and there's also for the older people, it's still there, and Windows, and you know, and look, I think it's one of the reasons why, again, going back to George Cheeks and CBS, he's greenlit the first soap opera in decades, and ostensibly, yes, it's going to be on CBS, and we'll have that platform. But it also will play on Paramount Plus, and it's going to be geared towards, it's going to be with Black Americans, Black leads, and it's going to sort of like, I think, bring in a lot of people and have it. There are a lot of people will watch it on Paramount Plus, which does do a good job of getting people to open the app if they're into it. It's unfortunately a horrible app with a horrible user interface
yes,
that
it
I
is.
Cannot stand and no algorithm, but it works.
So Peacock and Paramount Plus that we talked about earlier at 6 and 7, but in the middle there at 4 and 5, you've got Prime Video and Apple TV Plus. You mentioned a little bit about the reaction to Apple TV Plus. Interesting, right? Like, well, you said it earlier, Apple and Amazon are putting money into the entertainment industry in a way that, obviously that's new the last few years. And to see them here in the middle, I kind of agree with that. Like, content wise, I watch a lot of Apple TV stuff, and it's not just because I write about Apple as a technology company for a living. I think it is because I really appreciate, like, they make the best sci-fi shows at this point. They make a lot of good genre shows, including like other genres than sci-fi, like Slow Horses for spy thriller. You know, pretty good content. Severance, you know, basically because of the strike, took a year off, but is coming back. Like, a lot of good stuff there. And Apple seems to be happy to spend the money in exchange for the, you know, the spotlight of having acclaimed content as part of their ecosystem. And then Amazon seems to, it lost its way for a while, and it seems to have in the last few years kind of got it together about what it needs to be. I still hate their app, but I think that Jen Psaki has done a pretty good job in on the content side.
No, Jen really has, and I think Amazon also, they innovate in a way that a lot of streamers, tech streamers, don't. You know, they've been willing to pivot. You know, they launched a show like The Boys as a all episodes at once for season one. It saw it exploded. It got big, and they took the risk. Said we're going to make it a weekly series, mm-hmm. and guess what? People followed along, and yep. it worked. They pivoted. They are doing different windows with licensing. They're producing a game show, which is something again very low cost and costs nothing, but it can get, especially if they eventually go to daily, it gets people a different audience. They've got something called the 1% Club with Patton Oswalt. But they sold a window to Fox, and they worked out originally they announced it as 10 days, but I think it's down to just one day. It premieres on Prime, and the next day it's on Fox. Well, guess what? Fox is paying part of the production. They're getting advertising on Prime now, and it's they're trying something else. They're trying the soap opera. They're making dad TV in a way that's sort of like middle America. They're leaning into that.
The daddiest of dad TV is on
the
Prime
daddiest
video.
Of dad TV, right. And yet, but yet they also will, you know, they'll do stuff with J-Lo, or they'll do stuff with Nicole Kidman, whatever. So they're all over again. They are hurt by the fact that, you know, it's weird. I think, and to some degree, Apple too. They're part of these companies that sort of impose their vision on everything. So Apple doesn't market its shows well. They've been through lots of marketing chiefs. They don't tell their own story to the press because Apple just doesn't talk to the press. Even though I know the people who run Apple TV forever, they're just not talking on the record most of the time. I have a feeling with their fifth anniversary, they'll probably be like in the New York Times or somewhere. Hopefully they'll be in Vulture. We'll see. but they don't market in the way that they don't know. And people are confused, but the Amazon app is, you know, for all the money they have in the world, even when they redesign the app, it still sucks. It's slightly better than it used to be, believe it or not. It really is, but it's still horrible. And it doesn't surface all the amazing deep library content. They have the best. People say, oh, no one's putting movies from before the 90s on. Amazon sure does. They've got tons of it. You just never know because it's buried and they never recommend it. So those problems are real, but on the content wise, it works. And, you know, if it's getting people to, you know, the NFL and everything else, if it's getting people to, you know, buy more stuff on Amazon.com, plus now they're huge in advertising. People complain about the fact that they switched everyone to an ad program. And I get that. They also didn't raise the rate. So I think they should make it more easier so that you can pay ahead of for a year or something, or they're eventually, I think they're going to do an Amazon Plus program, Prime Plus, where you get grocery delivery free and you also get ad free. I mean, there are ways they could do things. But it makes sense because now they can monetize their content to advertisers and they've got this huge audience that they can sell. And I think that's also smart too. So they're doing a lot right.
Yeah, I think so. With Julia and I, in one of her last episodes, we talked about the fact that they've got, with their sports stuff and their ad tier, like Amazon is all about selling, and it essentially is all about targeting and advertising. And we don't like talking about that, but if you're talking about it as a pure business kind of play, like, of course, Amazon is going to show you ads. Like, that's the brilliance of it, is that they can specifically target things in a way that maybe nobody else can do. And that is powerful now that we live in a world where most of these streaming services have a basic ad tier. And so they're going to know who you are, and they're going to their interest in, sorry to take you back to sports for a second, Joe, but their interest in working with Diamond to do to bail out the Diamond Regional Sports Networks is in part the idea that they're intrigued with the idea of being able to additionally geo-target audiences watching sports, because sports content all has ads. Everybody who watches sports sees the ads. Even if you pay for an ad-free tier, you see the ads on sports. And then they know, you know, you're in Phoenix, Arizona metro, and they know exactly what ads to serve to you. And that is, you know, Amazon is a company that is very good at using technology to make money. So
they really are, and they're frustrating in a lot of ways, and they're also stubborn in their own ways too. You know, the fact that, you know, the Prime Video user interface looks like everything else on Amazon. It's like, but is that really what's right for the customer? No, it's not.
No.
But that's how they are, and I feel like it's amazing these companies that started off as renegades. They're bloated. And I think they sort of got a lot of institutional creep already. And it's really sad to watch, and I wish that Jeff Bezos no longer runs day to day things at Amazon, but I wish that they would empower their people to really sort of, be a little bit more, a little more self-sufficient, a little thinking on their own. But
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well, I think we've reached the end of this episode, although I will put a shout out if people want to send in letters. We're still taking them, downstreamfeedback.com. We'll do some more letters next time. If you haven't yet, please consider subscribing to Downstream Plus. We're still doing this. It's going to be good. This was a full-sized episode for everyone, but the complete version of our next episode will be available only for subscribers. Go to downstream.plus to subscribe and support the show. You can find me at sixcolors.com. I appear on many other podcasts at Relay FM and theincomparable.com. And Joe Adalian, where can people find your stuff? Vulture.com is probably the easiest way. Anything else we should plug?
I am on Blue Sky and the service formerly known as Twitter under at TV Mojo, MOJOE. So you can reach me there and, you know, that's where I'll be.
Cool. This was fun. Thank you so much for coming on.
I had a blast.
With Julia leaving, you know, I can't do this all alone. My mom always asks me, like, do you just do these podcasts by yourself? I'm like, no, you can't do that. You have to talk to somebody. So
I have mom. I have friends.
I'm so glad that you could come on because I've been admiring your stuff from afar for so long. And this was a lot of fun.
This was a lot of fun. And anytime, love to come back.
All right. Thanks. And thanks to everybody out there for listening. We will see you next time.